something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, you go first.
Me go first?
You go first.
Oh, you're so polite.
Oh, well, thank you.
And which is, of course, the topic that we are talking about today, because we're talking about how opening doors, holding the elevator, all those little things, those please and thank yous, the niceties that can make all the other little indignities of life seem not so much of a big deal.
Oh, the elevator. I'm so glad to not use an elevator anymore every day to get to the office.
In our new building,
yeah,
right.
I just take the stairs. It saves me that feeling you get when you rush ahead onto the elevator, and then you realize there's someone else coming.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't look at them, then you're not obligated to keep the door open.
Yeah, there's a whole, we've talked about this before.
Oh, yeah, we did actually the whole episode
did,
on elevators.
Yeah, elevator etiquette, and how a lot of that, like your politeness is probably tied to the algorithm of that mm-hmm. elevator, because if you know that elevator is only going to come every 240 seconds, you're not probably going to hold the open door button for that person.
Yeah, the algorithm for the stairs is pretty simple, and that's if I slip and fall, probably nobody will find me in there because no one uses those stairs.
And that's the interesting thing about politeness too, is that, I hope that you don't slip and fall, by the way.
Okay,
that would
you.
Be terrible. That's the interesting thing about politeness is that it seems like at face value, it's pretty straightforward. But as we will get into, there is a kind of algorithm in place that dictates our levels of politeness and when we engage in it.
Yeah, we're constantly tuning our politeness level to meet every face, every situation. It's ultimately, I keep thinking of this massive spider web, and it's holding us all in our place in society, our place in our interpersonal relationships, and we depend on that webbing just to hold it all together.
That sounds kind of dastardly, the web of politeness.
Yeah, because there's a big spider there somewhere, right?
Indeed, ready to gobble us up. But, you know, one of the things that we came across in our research is that politeness, as well-intentioned as it can sometimes be misconstrued.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example of this is holding doors open for men.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And there's a research paper entitled, When Door Holding Harms, Gender and the Consequences of Non-Normative Help, by Megan McCarty and Janice Kelly. And I think that title kind of says it all.
Non-normative help. Yeah.
Non-normative help. So what we're talking about here 196 unsuspecting men and women stepping through two portals into a Purdue University building. But first, they were approached by a male member of the research team as they walked toward the building. For half, the research associate, quote, took a step in front of the participant, opened the door, and let the participant walk through the front door first. Very chivalrous, right? Mm-hmm. For the other half, he reached for the adjacent door so that the two opened their doors more or less simultaneously. Would you think that there would be weirdness from this?
Yeah, I think there would. I would think there would be.
Yeah. I mean, initially I wouldn't have thought so, but once those people got on the other side of that door, there was a female research associate, and she approached each subject and asked him or her to complete a short survey. And on a 1 to 10 scale, they indicated their agreement with three statements measuring self-esteem, including, quote, I feel that I'm a person of worth, at least on an equal plane with others, and three measuring self-efficacy, including I can usually achieve what I want if I work hard for it. And the results is that male, and only males, reported lower levels of self-esteem and self-confidence if the door had been held open for them.
Oh, so it comes down to like the basic power to enter a space and your self-worth in entering it. If someone is opening the door for you, then your masculine reptilian brain can't handle it.
Or your gender performing self can't handle it. And that's the gender performing part is interesting because there's a guy named Irving Goffman, a Canadian American sociologist, and he viewed society through what is called symbolic interaction perspective. So this is kind of like everyday behavior in the interactions between people to help explain why society is the way that it is. And Goffman applied something called dramaturgical analysis in order to study this kind of social interaction. So he looked at this as really theater performance. In his 1959 book, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, he looked at self as an image deriving from the perceptions and responses of others that create the face of the person, and two, as the actor, as a player in a game or a set of rituals. So for self-preservation's sake, the self, especially the actor representing yourself, mm-hmm. right, would be interested in cooperation, signs and symbols, and well-understood practices in society, like, hey, you don't open the door for me. I'm a strong man. I don't need another man to do that, right? So in other words, for most of us, we inhabit these actor selves on stage responding to an audience, whoever that audience is, and we try to guide the impression and form the identity through the gaze of others. And our backstage selves are hidden away. And this is where a lot of this idea of politeness and how we perform it comes into play.
I like the use of signs, symbols, and ritual in this because it makes it sound like every interaction we have, every little polite interaction is ultimately just a ritualistic activity dealing with an abstract self, which kind of holds true, yeah.
I mean, because everything has some sort of context to it that we all understand the game rules to, right?
Right, yeah.
Like if you were just given this object and you had never seen it before, you wouldn't know what to do with it or how to interact with it. You would need someone to tell you, like, this is this sphere and you can open up one of the compartments. I'm holding an actual, like, sphere-like thing. And it's empty and you mm-hmm. can put paper clips in it. Otherwise, if you'd never seen it before, you'd be like, what is this alien thing?
Yeah. I mean, every little interaction, particularly the holding the door scenario that we've been discussing here, it's kind of its own little micro reality. It's its own little game with a set of rules and expectations. And no matter what else is going on in the office building or the environment or the country or the personal lives that are going on, you have to enter that micro reality at least for a few seconds and deal with it.
Full disclosure here.
Mm-hmm.
Over the past couple of years, myself and a couple of the other HowStuffWorks female staff workers here have been holding doors open for men
mm-hmm.
and then just seeing if they have a certain kind of body language afterward. And just for the record, the only person who has not allowed us to open the door for him and not knowing what was going on mm-hmm. at all was Scott Benjamin of CarStuff.
Oh.
He was the nicest, most polite person in the world.
He knows the rules of the game, and he's not going to allow you to break them.
Nope. No.
All right, so Goffman's theory, that was 1959, early 60s, that comes out. The next step in this study of politeness comes from 1978 with politeness theory from husband and wife researchers Stephen C. Levinson and Penelope Brown. The basic concept here is that people have a social self-image and they consciously project it, okay? The self-image is called face, as in, you know, to say face. And it has a dual nature, positive face and negative face. Positive face seeks approval, while negative face wants to be left alone, doesn't want to be imposed upon. Now, what face do you have? What face are you dealing with? I mean, it all depends, especially when you're dealing with a face-threatening act, or an FTA, where the face that you're wearing is essentially challenged. And, of course, there are two shades of this as well. Positive FTAs are a direct challenge to face or self-image. You can think of this in terms of an insult, a socially inappropriate comment, something of that nature. Meanwhile, negative FTAs are far more confrontational. Somebody has to budge. Somebody has to act. An imposition is being made. The example that keeps coming to my mind on this one, on the negative FTA, is Dr. Seuss's story, The Zacks. It's a very short little story in the book The Sneetches.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a north-going Zack and a south-going Zack, and they meet together in, I believe, the Desert of Pax. And neither one is going to budge. Like, the one is saying, you have to get out of my way because I'm going north, and that's the way I roll. And then the south-going Zack says, no, I'm going south, and you're in my way, and you've got to get out of the way because that's how I roll. And neither one budges. And civilization builds up around them, and roads are built over them in the Highway of Pax. But yeah, so that's
simply because they're not engaging in the act of cooperation,
right? And that's ultimately what is happening in a negative FTA is somebody has to budge.
And I was thinking about the term FTA, this facial threatening act. That sounds so dramatic. But have you ever been in a situation where you've been with another person or a group of people,
mm-hmm.
and everything's pretty light, and then one person's face falls and drops out of that sort of cooperative thing. And it's really a very unsettling thing to see that, because it's so clear that that person is upset or feels threatened or is threatening another person.
Yeah, like the classic example would be you accidentally make some sort of faux pas. You make an off-color joke, and unknowingly it affects somebody on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So politeness theory essentially is driving home the idea that politeness serves to both reflect and regulate our social distance.
Now, politeness theory identifies four politeness strategies that a speaker uses. And the first is what is called a balled-on strategy. And it's a direct approach that you would use with someone that you know really well, so like a family member or mm-hmm. a loved one. So, for example, you're at home visiting your parents. You might say, I want pizza for dinner, right?
Okay.
Very direct. The second strategy, because, by the way, you don't have to worry about their faces falling so much, right?
Yeah.
I would appreciate
a please from the child on the pizza.
Sure, but, you know. Right. But again, you don't have to worry about the FTA factor too much.
Right.
The second strategy, the positive politeness strategy, shows you recognize that your audience or the person you're talking to has a desire to be respected. It also confirms that the relationship is friendly and expresses group reciprocity. So perhaps the request would be something like, is it okay if we have pizza for dinner tonight? You know, it's just a little bit softer of a lob there.
Yeah.
The negative politeness strategy, the third strategy, also recognizes audiences' faces, but it also recognizes that you are in some way imposing upon them. Okay, so again, we're seeing degrees of relationships removed here. So maybe mm-hmm. this is someone I wouldn't normally have dinner with, mm-hmm. and I don't know what the preferences are. So you could say something like, you know, I don't want to impose upon you or anything, but I was thinking that pizza would be great. Okay, so semantically, you're throwing in some more stuff there to create that distance. And then the final strategy is called the off-record indirect strategy. And this is super. I love this because it takes a lot of the pressure off of you because you're really trying to avoid this direct face-threatening act of asking for pizza or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
right? So what you do is you say something along the lines of, hey, it's National Pizza Day. I heard that restaurants are giving 10% of their profits to UNICEF. And you're trying to make that person anticipate what you're saying and make the decision for you.
Yeah, almost make them decide to do the thing you want them to do. Almost Jedi mind trick them, right?
Yeah. All in an attempt to avoid the dreaded FTA, right? and an attempt to secure cooperation.
Now, I made the analogy of a web earlier about everyone being suspended in this web. And I keep coming back to that in part because distance is such a key aspect of all of this. And when I talk about distance, I'm talking about not only spatial distance, as definitely space plays into any polite interaction, how far am I away from that individual, but also psychological distance, semantic distance, temporal distance, we'll get into, especially when you think of in terms of sending a letter or an email to somebody, when is it going to be received? When in time are you addressing someone? So politeness theory suggests that three aspects of interpersonal situations are universally related to politeness. Number one, the relative power of the addressee over the speaker. Number two, the degree of imposition of the to-be-performed act. And number three, the social distance between the speaker and the addressee. As such, according to the theory, speakers use more polite language when addressing individuals with a higher status than individuals with equal or lower status. They use more polite language when asking for a bigger favor versus a smaller one and when addressing strangers versus familiar people. None of that should come as a surprise, right?
Right.
You're dealing with a police officer that just pulled you over. You're gonna roll out all the polite niceties, right? Far more than you would, with just, a teller at a local store, right? So, a 2010 paper from a Tel Aviv University Department of Psychology investigated how politeness affects and is affected by the level of construal distance, temporal distance, and spatial distance. And they predicted that greater politeness would be associated with higher levels of greater temporal and spatial distance. So in examining this, they conducted no fewer than 8 separate studies. And most of these were written evaluations, tests, quizzes, pretty exciting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of it, they had some pretty key findings that shed some light on just how politeness works within a cultural construct. They said people were more polite when they addressed a person they construed in terms of abstract goals and dispositions rather than concrete means and situations. So this would be an example. This would be a general meeting with a boss as opposed to a "we've got to hit this deadline. Where are you standing on this project?" meeting with a boss. Okay.
Okay.
They were more polite when they expected the target to receive the message in the relatively distant future. When they referred to relatively distant future actions, and when they addressed individuals in relatively distant locations. And they found that a request to generate polite statements prompted participants to use abstract verbs. So the example here would be, "can you help me with some lecture materials?" is coded as more abstract than "can you show me some lecture materials?"
Okay, so show is more of a demand.
Yeah, it's, the difference between, "hey, can you help me with this?" and "hey, can you do half of this for me?"
Right.
Yeah. They found that the polite utterances were judged as pertaining to the relatively distant future and were judged as directed to addressees in relatively remote locations, which is interesting. We can all think of examples where may have addressed someone and said, "hey, if you have time to get to this, there's no rush on this, but if you have a minute, can you maybe unload the dishwasher?" And you're already sort of pushing that event, that unloading of the dishwasher, into a more distant future. You're establishing more temporal distance between you and the person you're addressing, even if the dishwasher really needs to be unloaded in the immediate future.
Yeah, and you are employing that negative politeness strategy too, right? The opposing part.
The Tel Aviv study also said that when instructed to use polite language in addressing another person, participants preferred a relatively large spatial distance from that person. So they're actually preferred to stand a little farther away from the individual, or perhaps be isolated from them across a larger desk. So politeness and distance seem to go hand in hand. It's almost the equivalent. I keep thinking of, you know, we can't help but make caveman analogies with any of these sort of basic underpinnings of human behavior studies. But I think of like of somebody encountering like an enraged ape, and you don't want to make eye contact with them. You don't mm-hmm. want to establish that closeness with them because there's danger. So you would do more to distance yourself from the danger and employ more politeness.
And that's where the FTA comes from, right?
Right.
That's where the drama of that comes from. So that's on the request side of things, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of shows how tentative or sometimes how we kind of loathe to even ask for help, right?
Right.
And how we do it. So if you are on the flip side and someone's asked you something, how effective are sweet little nothings like thank you, right? Adam Grant and Francesca Gino ran 4 experiments looking at how the thank you sentiment played out with helpers. And the research, by the way, is published in the June 2010 issue of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. In the first study, they had 69 participants who were asked to provide feedback to a fictitious student named Eric. Now, the participants didn't know this was a fictitious student. They just got some feedback, or they just got an email from him. And so he asked for a little bit of feedback on his cover letter for a job application. Now, after sending their feedback through by email, they got a reply from Eric asking for more help with another cover letter. Half of them received this follow-up with a thank you incorporated into it. And half of them received a follow-up from Eric that was neutral with no thank you in it. So the results were that 32% helped Eric in comparison to 66% when those people received a thank you. So already you can see that 32 to 66, that's a pretty big impetus for trying to help someone again if you receive that little small token of gratitude. And this has a kind of pay it forward aspect to it, because the next day these same participants received another request, this time from a fictitious person named Steven, who asked if they could help him. And the percentage who offered to help Steven was 25% when they had received no gratitude from Eric. But this shot up to 55% when they had been thanked by Eric.
Huh. So the politeness of Eric spilled over into their willingness to help Steven.
Exactly. Yeah. So it affected that. And that's that sort of pay it forward aspect to it. Now, their third and fourth studies yielded similar results, but they used face-to-face scenarios and all had the same idea that the simple act of gratitude was helping to ratchet up the feelings of self-worth in the respondents, in the participants. So it's not just a nicety of saying, hey, thank you so much. It's actually kind of feeding into the ego a bit.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, how then each interaction is kind of helping to maintain the social order of the politeness algorithm.
Yeah, because it's basically saying, I'm imposing upon you. My apologies. Can you help me? Because we live in this cooperative society, and that's how we've survived as a species. How about it? And the other person says, sure, here you go. And the other person says, thank you for doing that. I know you didn't need to.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss what's the most polite country in the world, what's the least polite country in the world, and can you be too polite?
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, we're back. What is the most polite country in the world? Now, I'm sure everyone has their own sort of individual take on this based on their own individual interactions with other cultures and other countries. But generally speaking, when people talk about polite cultures and phenomenal politeness, they talk about Japanese politeness.
They are famous for it.
Yes. And indeed, when we say phenomenal, it is studied as a phenomenon by researchers. Linguistic politeness in Japanese culture was especially been an item of study by Stanford's Yoshiko Matsumoto, professor of Japanese language and linguistics. In her work in the late 80s and early 90s, Matsumoto argued that the themes of Anglo-Saxon individualism in politeness theory doesn't even really work with Japanese culture. That the very concept of face, particularly that of negative face, is ultimately just kind of alien to the Japanese. She said, quote, "What is of paramount concern to a Japanese is not his or her own territory, but the position in relation to others in the group and his/her acceptance of others. Loss of face is associated with the perception of others that one has not comprehended and acknowledged the structure and hierarchy of the group." So an example of this that we see in just the linguistics of the whole scenario. In English, when we meet somebody, what do we say?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, which, of course, is such an empty statement. It's nice. Like, what is nice?
What is nice? Like, and even, like, it's a pleasure to meet you. Is it a pleasure? Like, chocolate is a pleasure?
Yeah. Yeah, it's such an empty statement, but you have to say it. You have to say something or some version of it because it's just part of the contract, part of the back and forth. It's the rules of the game. Okay. But it's certainly a phrase with a lot of distance in it, right? It's just merely nice to meet you, to make your acquaintance. lots of spatial distance, lots of symbolic distance.
Lots of, hey, let's start this on a positive foot.
Yes.
Yeah.
We are, this is very clinical, really. However, in Japan, a typical form of greeting is the following, and I apologize to our Japanese-speaking listeners. I'm sure I'm not going to hit this correctly. Dozu yor oshiko ogamash, which means, I ask you to please treat me well, take care of me. Which, to foreign ears, it might sound a little personal.
It sounds very vulnerable and very honest, right?
Yeah. It's like, hey, take care of me. Suckle me, you know, feed me, clothe me.
I don't think the suckle me is.
Okay.
Right. But it does have an aspect to it that's like, hey, I'm meeting you. I'm vulnerable and treat me well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's much more, that resonates a lot more than nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, if you were going to go strictly by politeness theory, however, this would be a bit of a negative face imposition, right? It lacks the distance of that English language politeness. But in this, it really zeroes in on the focus on interdependence in Japanese culture. And that interdependence even has a special name in Japanese culture, amaru. And it's all about placing yourself in another's care as a sign of respect. Respecting your elders and realizing that you're ultimately under their protection, under their guidance, and therefore it's a sign of respect, and you're recognizing the existing social hierarchy by saying, please take care of me.
Okay, so instead of denying the threat as, hey, nice to meet you, everything's good here, right? Mm-hmm. There is no threat. It's more an acknowledgement of a possible threat.
Yeah.
Right, hey, take care of me. I know that you could not do me a solid here.
Right.
But please do.
Yeah, and if you fail to recognize this hierarchy and the ranking here and the interconnectedness, then you're creating an impression of ignorance or lack of self-control. And then you lose face for real.
Huh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the least polite country, this one is a lot harder to get to. A lot of people, when it's represented in the media at least, frame it as sort of a tourist goes to this country and they find these people to be rude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's erroneous in terms of logic anyway, because it's, that sort of experience is freighted with cultural expectations and violations of norms, right?
Yeah.
So my norm in the United States is going to be different than someone else's norm in France, for instance.
Right.
So the best way to get at this is, again, to go more toward that direct, indirect nature of language. And this is really plumbed by Eva Ogerman's excellent article, Politeness and Indirectness Across Cultures, A Comparison of English, German, Polish, and Russian Requests. Again, indirect, direct, and requests that we're dealing with here. And she writes that English and German, for example, tend to contain the more distancing and polite indirect request, whereas Russian and Polish is more direct. She writes, quote, what Brown and Levinson's theory does not account for is that some cultures appreciate pragmatic clarity while associating directness with honesty. Indirect requests, on the other hand, not only increase, quote, the interpretive demands on the hearer, in other words, you have to really listen carefully if I'm saying, hey, it's National Pizza Day, to try to figure out what it is that I'm hinting at.
Mm-hmm.
She says, but can also, quote, make the speaker sound devious and manipulative.
And coming back to the Jedi mind trick thing, why are you trying to trick me into thinking pizza is a great idea when really you just want me to, you just want pizza?
Right. So she's saying in this example, the Russian hearer isn't necessarily discounting that direct approach because that feels more honest. And she also says the Russian hearer does not necessarily regard a request as an imposition on her or his personal freedom, and a potential refusal involves less face loss for a Russian speaker than it does for somebody with an Anglo-Saxon cultural background. In other words, if you make a request and the person says no, then it's not as heart-wrenching as it would be in an Anglo-Saxon exchange.
It's interesting, too. When you think of Russian culture, one of the sort of stereotypes that comes to mind is very close personal interaction during greetings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kisses on the face, even, one man kissing another on the face, or Vladimir Putin kissing a small boy, and it's all perfectly acceptable.
Well, you're right. So you see that correlation with there's a directness with language and there's a directness with personal space. So the nonverbal and verbal match up.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in Japanese culture, you definitely see more of a spatial distance in interactions as a whole.
And yet both of them, you would think of them as being completely different, but both of them are treading on the concept of honesty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And ultimately, like, no matter what particular culture you're looking at, and their various levels of politeness, their various semantic systems of politeness, I mean, it's all coming down to maintaining that webbing, maintaining that system of interactions that keeps everyone sane and functional.
Right. So in this respect, there's a worth to being agreeable, mm-hmm. right, to putting yourself out there, to being polite. But the question then comes up, could you be too agreeable? Could you be too almost obedient?
Yes. And in this, we get into Stanley Milgram's obedience study, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with already, at least, surface level. And of course, this is where we end up discussing the Holocaust while examining politeness. This study from Milgram came up in the 1960s. Particularly, the experiments began in July 1961, just 3 months after the start of the trial of German Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem. So the idea here, of course, is were millions of individuals just following orders when it came to the Holocaust, or were they actual accomplices? Could you essentially just be so polite and fall in line, and in doing so, you know, lead straight to the gates of hell? So that's what he decided to examine in a series of experiments. And it's worth noting that there were 19 of these in all. This wasn't just one single experiment, but they were all kind of shades of the same, but they're all sort of shades of the same format. Okay. So basically, particularly with the most well-known, example of the experiment, which I think was experiment five, you had 40 men recruited using newspaper ads, paid $4.50 each. They were brought in and divided into groups. So you had teachers who were asked to pull a lever and administer a shock every time a learner answered a question incorrectly. Learners were heard but not seen, and they were part of the experiment. There wasn't really somebody being shocked in the next room. They were just pretending to be shocked, you know. All the while, the learners are complaining about the shocks, which increased by 15 volts for each wrong answer. At the 300-volt level, the learners bang on the wall for a release, and beyond this, there's only silence. And at this point, the experimenter, the authority figure in the scenario, instructs the participant to treat this silence as an incorrect response and deliver a further shock to the learner. Okay? So
okay.
It's a pretty kind of diabolical scenario. Going into this, it was predicted that no more than 3 out of 100 participants would actually deliver that maximum shock to a silent learner.
Only three.
Okay. That was one of the predictions going in.
Okay.
In reality, 65% of the participants in Milgram's best-known study, again, Experiment 5, delivered the maximum shock. 35% then were refusing to administer that highest shock level to this individual who is presumably unconscious mm-hmm. or even dead following these previous shocks. Now, the obedience rates were different depending on the experiment. Again, there were 19 of them, and they varied with the scenario a bit in each one. Obedience rates dropped to 47.5% in a rundown apartment building environment versus a Yale campus environment for experiment number 5.
Okay.
And then there was yet another experiment in which the learners only had to take notes about the shock. They didn't have to actually administer it. And in that, obedience rates hit 92.5%. So they were just bureaucratically a part of the shock, and therefore they were more obedient.
So the more distance, mm-hmm. the more they could sort of objectify that person.
Yeah, exactly.
And then carry that out.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, we'll boot it!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and last hour on the business. I understand now. It's a wise man marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh?
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So how this plays into politeness theory and politeness across cultures, Milgram was essentially an evolutionary psychologist. And the central idea here is that there is a survival advantage to submitting to authority. He recognized that humans evolved a psychological mechanism for obedience, which he called the agentic state. And in this state, normal moral inhibitions are bypassed and we become a mere agent of an authority. So the idea here is that there's an evolutionary advantage to politeness. There's an evolutionary advantage to staying in line with the social norms and obeying the authority figures that are sending you orders, suggestions, what have you.
Okay. Now, to explore this, there was an extension of the Milgram study by researchers at the University of Grenoble Alps in France, published in the 2014 edition of the Journal of Personality. And they wanted to see which personality types were more or less likely to obey orders that resulted in pain to others. Mm-hmm. And so participants were 35 males, 31 females, aged 26 to 54, from the general population. And they were contacted by phone 8 months after their participation in a study transposing Milgram's obedience paradigm. And these interviews were presented as opinion polls with no stated ties to the earlier experiment. And the personality was assessed by the Big Five Mini Markers questionnaire, which was also used in the Milgram studies. And this includes categories of personality like conscientiousness and agreeableness. Now, political orientation and social activism were also measured. And results confirmed hypotheses that the conscientiousness and agreeableness would be associated with willingness to administer high-intensity electric shocks to a victim. The subjects, what we're seeing here, again, had a more agreeable and conscientious personality, this sort of disposition, and they were more likely to follow the orders given to them, even if it meant delivering these painful shocks so that they didn't go against authority. So just sort of underscores all of what you were talking about with the Milgram studies. Now, this is interesting. People with more left-wing political leanings were less likely to deliver the painful shocks. And a particular group of study participants were described as holding steady and refusing to harm others. And this group was women who had previously participated in rebellious political activism.
Huh.
And I think all of this kind of, all this circles back to why do atrocities happen? Does politeness really factor that much into obedience? Can it be so extreme that, that it ties back to the survival instinct of authorities and obedience?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's gonna vary depending on the particular cultural situation as well as the political climate.
Right. But it's all really fascinating when you look at politeness in this way. It's not just the please and thank yous that we try to instill in children, you know, for good reason, because they will get more help.
Yeah.
But there's a lot more going under the cover here of the semantics of it.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we are talking about something that kind of, to an extent, holds us all together, or at least allows us to work within a given culture.
And I think that's why you see, too, in computer-mediated communication, talking about email, talking about Facebook, Twitter, so on and so forth, you see less of a regard for the feelings of others because you don't have that sort of, you know, face-to-face interaction. You don't have to see the look of spoilage across someone's face when you've said something terrible.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, the modern world of email and online reviews and Facebook comments, it really does skew everything a bit, especially when you start thinking again about those factors of distance and space, distance and time, and how that factors into you thinking about the other person on the other end of a given email or review.
Yeah, and again, it's occupying the headspace of the other person.
Yeah.
And kind of ties back to empathy as well. And I was thinking, even when you're thinking about the cadence of two people talking, there are specific rules in place there, rules that even whales observe.
Oh, yes. Yes, this is pretty interesting. Of course, whales are known for some of their whale songs, right? They're communicating with each other across vast distances. And what happens when those calls overlap, right? Those conversations overlap. Well, as it turns out, the whales are actually doing what they can to remain polite and courteous of those other conversations.
Yeah, Natalia Sidorovskaya of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette and her colleagues discovered that whales change the intervals between their echolocating clicks in a way that seems to prevent cluttering the echoes from these other calls. And she says, quote, in other words, whales are polite listeners. They do not interrupt each other, which would be really important because there's information that's trying to be disseminated here. And if you don't get the information, well, hey, that might affect your survival.
Yeah. I mean, it's the sort of the Jenga tower of communication. And certainly the human Jenga tower of intercommunication is far more complicated. But the simplified whale model illustrates that anytime there's a social system in place, you have to have at least some level of politeness to make it work.
Right, or else you're going to be shunned.
Yeah.
And that's the really the crux of all of this, whether it's from an authority figure or from the group, which, of course, led us to wonder if there are any whale jerks out there that have been ejected from the group because they keep talking over the other members.
Yeah, because we were talking earlier about this, like to what extent is whale society such that a rude whale just simply dies out and therefore nature selects for polite whales? Whereas in human culture, you unmistakably, you have individuals who don't really work well in polite society, but perhaps they have a skill that still makes them very valuable, you know? Like that, the guy at the primordial campfire, and maybe not primordial, yeah, like some guy at a prehistoric campfire who maybe he's not great about joining in with the post-meal conversation, but he's the best at grounding down, weasel bones into necessary paste. So you gotta keep him around.
And that's why we developed willful inattention, as we discussed in that episode about willfully ignoring someone.
Indeed. All right, so there you have it. Politeness. Hopefully you have a more nuanced understanding and appreciation for all those little niceties that fill our life and fill our interactions now. In the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all of the episodes, videos, blog posts, links out to social media accounts, you name it.
And if you have some cordial, genteel thoughts that you would like to share with us, we would love to hear them. You can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.